Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
The grower, they are not like winemaker. A winemaker grow their grapes and make the wine. Nobody will grow cacao going to make his own chocolate bar. They usually grow them, sell them, and they don't even taste the chocolates. So this is why I invest into small cacao plantation and start to produce my own cacao.
Mr. Chocolate Jacques Torres is back in the house. He's perhaps the most highly decorated pastry chef and chocolatier of his time. Welcome back, Jacques. And I see you have heeded my warning about not coming back empty-handed.
Yes, of course.
So a warm welcome to the chocolates you brought along.
Always happy to do that.
So let's talk about this decision to embark on bean-to-bar chocolate, as opposed to chocolate that you buy in bar form, or that, as you say, you buy in some in-between form that will result in the hated mediocrity.
Basically, what's going on is bean-to-bar is a phenomenon that's maybe 15 to 20 years old, no more than that. There was very few chocolate makers from the cacao bean to the chocolate bar 20 years ago.
So, there was the famous guy in France who was doing it in his shop, right?
Yes, its name is Pralut, François Pralut.
Right.
I think that's who you talk about. But in America, even, there was very few people who was making chocolate, starting from the beans all the way to the bar. Then that became very fashionable to make bean-to-bar.
Right, Schaffenberger.
I mean, Schaffenberger is doing certainly a pretty good job doing it. I'm talking about the even smaller people who do, you know, even less than 50 pounds at a time.
And even Schaffenberger is not the same now that it's been sold to
Yes,
Hershey,
you're right.
So.
You're
anyway.
Right. But that being said, I really believe that if you do it, you have to do it very seriously. It's actually complicated. And you need quite a bit of equipment to do that. So eventually, you know, I was able to buy what I need to do it and to learn. You have to learn. It's a craft. And you know, when you roast your beans, if they are different size, then you have to divide the size because the small beans going to burn and the big beans are not cooked. So, you know, this is...
So what are the steps?
So first you have to buy cacao beans. And this is, to me, the most difficult things. You have to know what you are buying. And it's very difficult to become an expert in cacao beans. You have to look at the cacao beans and you cut them in half and you look at the color and you decide, I want those beans and I'm going to invest 1 ton, 2 ton, 3 ton of those cacao beans. And it's pricey. You cannot make a mistake. And then you have to decide if they are over-fermented, under-fermented, if they have mold or if they have, you know, insect. So if you don't make any mistake and you have good cacao beans, then the first step is going to clean them. You need to be sure that you have no stone or piece of wood or anything with them. And then you need to roast them. And roasting is actually complicated because they don't change color. A cacao bean is a cacao bean. The roasted or not, the color is the same. So it's only flavor. So you need to taste. Then when you roast them and they are very fruity and you're happy with the degree of roasting, then you're going to put them in a machine called a winnower. And the winnower is going to crack those beans, not smash them, just crack them and remove the shell. And you're going to be left with something called the nibs. The nibs is the inside of the roasted cacao beans. Now, from the nibs, you're going to make a paste called cocoa liquor. And then you're going to taste your cocoa liquor and decide if you're going to make a 60, 70, 80% cocoa content.
Got it.
So when you decide that, then you do your calculation. You mix the paste with the sugar, and then you put that in a machine called a refiner. The refiner is 3 to 5 rolls that are going to crunch that paste into a particle size of no more than 20 microns. So very small. Then you put that in another machine called a conch. And the conch going to stir this product and heat this product and stir it and oxidize it for 8 to 72 hours. It really depends on what you want. And then after that, you're going to add a little bit of cocoa butter, maybe a little bit of lecithin, and then maybe vanilla. And then your chocolate is ready. You have to temper it. And you have to do whatever you want to do with it.
That's serious business.
It's
not like making a cup of coffee.
It's not. It takes time. It takes dedication. It takes knowledge. You have to do that very seriously. And again, don't settle for mediocrity, not with that. So out there, you can buy some chocolate called old-fashioned chocolates, as an example. It's because people who do that doesn't have the right equipment to refine the chocolates enough, so it's very grainy, so they call it old-fashioned. Or it's not conched properly, or, I mean, it's you have a little bit of everything out there. You know, I want to do it very seriously.
And can people taste the difference? I know you can.
You know, like everything else, you have people who really make a science of growing tomato. And is everyone, all consumer, know what a good tomato is? I'm sure not. But you certainly have a clientele who know what a good tomato is. And I'm talking about tomato, I can talk about, you know, meat or fish or chocolates or whatever you want to talk about. So you have certainly a clientele out there who is a connoisseur on good chocolates and will make a difference, yes.
When you started making bean to bar chocolate yourself, there were already some small people doing it.
Correct.
In the U.S. What changed? In other words, was it just part of the artisanal food movement? What got people interested in making bean to bar chocolate?
I do think that people realize that buying chocolate, melting it, and transforming it into something else was not maybe satisfying enough. You want to really go at the source of making the product. And to me, being a melter of chocolates, you know, melting that chocolate and transforming it into something else, or crafting my chocolates and then doing all that,
was a
lot more satisfying.
Yeah.
So I decided that I will do both. So I buy some chocolate from Belgium, and the chocolate that I buy is done the way I want. So I talk to the maker, I go to Belgium, I know what I want, and I ask them to do that for me, and they do. But also, I make chocolates, special batches in my factory, especially now that I invest into a plantation. We plant last summer 5,000 trees. They will be producing in 3 years. The rest of the plantation already produced cacao pod, so I use cacao pod from that plantation. We have a lot of what we call Criollo Blanco, which is, Criollo is maybe 1% of the chocolates or the cacao in the world, and Criollo Blanco is a small portion of that 1%. But when you make chocolates, the chocolate is not really dark. It's actually more of the milk chocolate's color with no milk. This is the color of the cacao beans. The flavor is amazing, and you can make an 85% cocoa contents that sometimes is unedible, but because that those high-quality beans, the chocolate is exceptional. It's not too bitter. The flavor is amazing. It's just, to me, it's a pleasure to just close my eye and eat a piece of chocolates like that. So it's not cheap to produce because they cost a lot. Those beans cost a lot of money. But you have a product that's pretty exceptional.
At this point, do you think there's a qualitative difference between high-end bean-to-bar chocolate that you're making or other small American producers and high-end French and Belgian and Swiss chocolate?
Ooh, that's a tough question. Yes. It's actually more people today making bean-to-bar around New York than you will have in all France. It's amazing the movements, or how this movement grow in U.S. You have few people doing it in France, but you definitely have more people doing it in U.S. Why? I don't know. But what interests me is people who build machinery today are building machinery for small maker to be able to make good bean-to-bar. So even equipment is changing. I was in Belgium a year ago, and they introduced to me a machine actually to refine and to conch that chocolate, which years ago doesn't exist. They make small batches. It used to be used for R&D by big company, Mars,
right,
and Hershey and Nestle and all those guys. Now you can find small equipment actually for small maker to make small batches, because it's difficult to buy those high-quality cacao bean, and you're going to find few bags. You might not find even 1 ton. But most people machine are too big. So now with those small equipment, you can make a 50-kilo batch.
Got it.
Or 100-pound batches.
seems like pastry chefs are pretty stubborn. If they hit upon a chocolate they like, they stay with it. And now they're encountering so many kinds of chocolate that people are trying to get them to use. Do you think pastry chefs continue to use what they know, the old-fashioned brands like Valrhona, rather than, you know, some of the newer chocolate makers?
You know, it's certainly like every industry. Valrhona is a sure value. They make chocolate for a long time. They know how to do it. They have great equipment. They know grower. They buy the right beans. And their chocolate is very good.
And they bought Maison de Chocolat, right?
And I don't know if... Yes. Let's say that they are part of the same group.
Right, exactly.
That's what's going on.
Yeah.
So it's like buying, I don't know, a Mercedes or you know, or a BMW. It's a sure value and you're going to get what you want and what you pay for. With smaller maker, you never know. You can get a bad batch or you can get a bad year and the chocolate is not going to be as exceptional or as consistent than a company like Valrhona. So, you know, I don't think Valrhona is a competitor because we do something completely different, but I do respect what Valrhona is doing. And it's a sure value. So some chefs will say, you know what, I want to get out of those roads that everybody is taking and take my chance, or I want to be sure that my chocolate is good and I'm going to stay with Valrhona.
Do you think there's lots of room to grow and evolve for chocolate making in America?
You know, chocolate is like wine. To make wine, you need good grapes. To make good chocolates, you need good cacao beans. Something is happening in the world of cacao beans. 50% in Ecuador of the chocolates, and in Peru, actually, of those cacao beans come from a plant called CCN51, which is an hybrid of different trees. That's going to give you between 7 and 10 times more cacao pod, beautiful cacao bean, relatively low tree, no need of shade. But the beans are not that good.
So high yield, low quality.
High yield, low quality. And you know what? In a way, we need that because otherwise there will not be enough cacao beans in the world. But we need those cacao beans. But the problem is, In place like Ecuador, where they used to have only good cacao beans, now you have those CCN. And in Peru, they have a big problem of people growing coca. So the government gives some money to the farmer and say, switch to cacao.
Right. Don't produce the coca leaf, which makes cocaine, switch to chocolate.
So they did. They did. And what do? They put the plant that produced the most, which is a CCN51. So now in Peru, about 50% of what's grown is CCN51, which is not the best chocolate. The big industry need it. Hershey, Mars, Nestle, all those guys need those trees.
Right.
But for us, small maker, who sell a chocolate bar, you know, starting at $5, $6, $7, we need better cocoa. So we always communicate with the grower. And the grower doesn't know. The grower, they are not like winemaker. A winemaker grow their grapes and make the wine. Nobody will grow cacao going to make his own chocolate bar. They usually grow them, sell them, and they don't even taste the chocolates. So this is why I invest into a small cacao plantation and start to produce my own cacao.
Wow. Are there small chocolate makers that you really, really admire in America? Dandelion or any of those?
Yes, it's a lot of good makers. America produce a lot of good and bad chocolates. So I don't have all the names, you know, that I will recall. But you have both things out there. You have very good chocolates and small makers that make excellent chocolates. And you have companies that don't have the right equipment and maybe doesn't do the right thing. But you have both there.
And do you think the best quality American small batch chocolate is up to the level of the best French chocolate or Belgian?
I think that people are making better and better chocolates. You have Johnny Uzzini today that's making certainly excellent...
Used to be the pastry chef at Daniel.
Yes.
And Jean-Georges. And
he opened a bean-to-bar place. I'm sure that he's doing an impeccable product. So yes, we certainly can compare what we do here than what's going on in France. I'm pretty sure this is fair to say.
And that wasn't always true, obviously.
No, but you see, everything is changing today with social media and also with this new generation of, I think, called millennials, who was born with those phone in their hands, get information so fast and get, I will say, all the... If you go to a chocolate shop and you want to talk to the chef, if you spend an hour on Google, you will know quite a bit about, you know, what is a Criollo tree, what is a Forastero, Trinitario, what's a Nibs. And when you go, you will sound that you have knowledge. You don't always have deep depth, knowledge, right, but you will sound that you have knowledge.
It's true.
So more and more people do their research. It's so easy. You know, when I start my profession, to learn what was in chocolate was so complicated.
Right, today and you could only do it learning from somebody in real life, in real time.
That was not exactly books to tell you. And professionals don't even want to teach you because they think that they lose the knowledge. So today, the knowledge is out there. Just look for it. Educate yourself. And I think more people get educated, more the makers going to have to make better products.
Mm-hmm.
That's where things are changing.
Because customers are demanding.
Demanding and get more and more educated.
Got it.
And more we're going to get that, better product we're going to get. In meat product, in fish product, in chocolate product, in cheese product, in coffee product, anything. We can get so much education today that it's easier to find better products.
Yeah. So you've actually, speaking of education, you've been teaching pastry and chocolate making.
That's something very important in my heart.
You do it at the International Culinary Center, right?
Yes.
Which used to be the French Culinary Institute.
I all my career, I was involved with teaching. From when I was at the Negresco, I was teaching in Cannes. Then when I came to America, I start to be friend to Dorothy Hamilton and to the French Culinary Institute.
Dorothy Hamilton is the founder of the French
Culinary. The founder, yes.
The late founder, just died. Tragically.
Tragically, unfortunately. And I've always been involved with education. And the reason is I believe that if someone give me part or almost all of what I know, my duty is to give that back. I cannot sit on knowledge. That knowledge going to go, I'm going to use it, but I'm going to give it back. I'm going to share that with the new generation. And what a better tools than working with a school. So I am the dean of the International Culinary Center, and I do demonstration, I write the curriculum, I work with the teacher, and it's important to me that what I know today doesn't will not be gone with me. That will be to the students to take that and go a little bit further than what I did with it.
So describe your ideal student.
To me, a good student will be someone who wants to learn, someone who has a passion. You cannot be a pastry chef or a chef without passion. Nothing is guaranteed in this profession. Let's say that you became a lawyer. Let's say that you became an architect or a doctor, or most likely you will make a reasonable living. You will make it to a certain level into your profession. Chefs, a very small percentage of the chef going to really make it.
Right.
It's a very difficult profession. So imagine that you're not sure that you're going to make it into the profession, and now you don't like it? Oh, my God.
Right. You're a double loser.
So be passionate about it. Become as good as you can. Be willing to learn and to change your mind if someone tells you something else. Don't be lazy. You cannot be lazy and be a pastry chef or a chef. And if you have all that and something in your hands, a good technique, then hopefully you will make it and be happy.
And you have to be prepared to be screamed at sometimes.
I don't think that we get much screaming in the kitchen anymore.
Was Maxima a screamer?
But I'm telling you, it used to be an abusive place for youngster. It used to be very... I mean, I talked to André Saltner, who was the chef and owner at Lutèce.
Which was the great French restaurant in New York that's now closed.
Yes, but at that time, he's now 84, I think. When he was 16 or even 14, that was physically abuse in the kitchen. So imagine from that time to today. Today, I don't think that you can scream at an apprentice anymore, but still you're going to work during the holiday. You're going to work late on the evening. You're going to to work on your, you're going to be in your feet the whole day. It's a difficult profession. Yeah. So be sure that you love it.
And is that the single most meaningful piece of advice you bestow on your students?
I do tell them, before you commit to it, try it. So during your summer, before you go to school, give your time to a restaurant and spend a couple months in a kitchen and see what it is to be a chef in and out. Because if after a couple months of doing that, if you still love it, then maybe you will be a good chef.
Got it.
But if you hate it, run from it and do something else.
So I want to talk about the difference between dark chocolate and milk chocolate, what you think of white chocolate, and now they've bestowed on the world pink chocolate. Okay. What's up with all that stuff?
Okay, let's start with dark chocolate. Dark chocolate is what I described earlier. It's cacao paste coming from the nibs, sugar, so you decide your amount of sugar, your 40%, 60%, whatever you're going to put in, a little bit of cocoa butter that comes from the nibs, 50% of the nibs is cocoa butter, and you usually add a tiny bit of cocoa butter to have a better mouthfeel, and sometimes vanilla and lecithin. Lecithin is a bonding agent, and vanilla, which is natural, going to give a nice flavor. Sometimes yes, sometimes not. You don't always use it. So this is dark chocolate.
Got it.
Milk chocolate is the same thing with a little bit less cocoa paste that you replace with milk powder.
Got it.
So easy to understand. Now, when you take the milk chocolates and you remove the cacao paste, the rest is white chocolate. So it's relatively easy to understand this way.
So do you regard white chocolate as actual chocolate?
Actually, I think it is, because you have cocoa butter, which is 50% of the cacao nibs, into the white chocolate, sugar, milk powder. This is the three main ingredients. And then lecithin and vanilla.
Got it.
So, you know, the cocoa butter comes from the cacao nibs, 50% of the cacao nibs. So, yes, it is somehow coming from the cacao plant.
And
it doesn't have the color.
Yeah. And have you learned to love white chocolate?
No. No, I never love it. And even milk chocolates, I don't love all milk chocolates.
Uh-huh.
But I have to say that a good milk chocolate is pleasant. And I have to say that a delicious dark chocolate is magical.
Yes. When I'm with you.
It's when
dark
it's
chocolate is magical.
And oh my God, you know, it can be really good.
And what's this new pink chocolate?
So I actually had a meeting this weekend with Cocoa Berry.
Cocoa Berry is one of the big...
Two companies, Cocoa Berry and another company. So those companies invent that pink chocolate. And what they tell us is it takes them 10 years to develop the pink chocolates. And it has milk in it, quite a bit of milk powder. And the process make it that the chocolate is pink naturally with no color. I don't have any more information. Is it the beans? Do they oxidize the beans? I don't know. So because I don't know, I cannot judge, or I cannot even, you know, extrapolate or talk about it. So let's see when that come out. But they say it will be a fourth category. It's not milk. It's not dark. It's not white. It's pink.
Got it.
So let's see what's happened with that. Barry Calbo. Calbot is the company that invent that pink chocolate.
Got it. So they're one of the big...
Huge. One of the biggest in the world.
International. Yes. Yeah. So where do you think chocolate is headed?
You see, I think it's headed in two directions. One toward the bottom, with all those hybrid and the way that chocolate is being made, more and more and more.
So that just means we'll always have Nestle's Crunch.
We always have relatively cheap chocolates.
Right.
And then, in another way, relatively high, because when you have those companies pulling toward the bottom, you're always going to have some makers that are going to say, no. I'm going to pay the price for those cacao beans, and I'm going to make the best chocolate possible. So I think it's going actually in both directions. You know, toward the bottom, but also, I think we never had so much good chocolates than today. The chocolate is better than 10 years ago. We have more high-end makers today than we had 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And I think that's going to keep going. More and more people will look for those white Criollo beans And remember, Criollo beans is less than 1% of the chocolates in the world. So thanks God we have those other beans, and you know that's those high volume beans.
And so there'll be discerning people that are willing to pay, that understand the difference for the what they're getting with the high end chocolate.
This is my guess. Yes. This is my guess.
And what do you think about the idea of introducing savory flavors or fresh herbs to chocolate? Like, where are you on that?
I don't think that it's anything new. Cacao is about what we know now over 5,000 years old. And it used to be used by the Mayan and even other cultures before them into ceremonials, but also into drinks and into cooking. So I believe that it's nothing new. I mean, mole exists for hundreds and hundreds of years, and mole is a savory dish where they use cacao nibs. I cook with nibs. I love to make a salmon dip into the nibs and pan fry into cocoa butter, which is a natural fat. So I have no problem mixing nibs and cacao paste into cooking. Where I have a problem is mixing, and that's something that I don't like personally. Maybe other people like it. Mixing sweet with, meaning sweet chocolate with something savory. That I'm not crazy about it. But I don't mind to put non-sweet chocolates into cooking.
And when you were a pastry chef at Le Cirque, you probably weren't doing much of that.
No, I am actually a pretty classical chef. I will try to take my classic and build over them. So the roots is always classical recipe and classical French pastry and chocolates. And then I build over that. I never go with no foundation and just put whatever into a dish. I'm a pretty classical chef.
And it's interesting because classic French pastry chefs sometimes have a problem with American bakers. Like, I was sitting with Francois Paillard when Sarah Levine had just won for Best Pastry Chef at the James Beard Foundation. And he said, "Ed, she's not a pastry chef. She's a baker. She makes brownies and cookies." So what's the difference between a French, classically trained French pastry chef and someone who makes brownies and cookies?
Okay, the difference will be maybe that we don't differentiate in America bakers and pastry chef. Bakers are people who are going to do bread and maybe muffin and cookies and brownies and all those things that you just bake. A pastry chef going to do more of the montage of the wedding cake and the very complicated and sophisticated desserts.
Sugar and all that.
So in France, we differentiate the two. Huh? You go to a bakery or you go to a pastry shop. So we naturally make a difference. And that's certainly where Francois comes from. But you know what? If in America we don't make a difference, then let's put the two professions together and you know, whoever won. And this is the way that I look at it. But I understand where Francois comes from, because if you look at that with your French mind, you're going to say, "Oh my God, she's not a pastry chef, she's a baker." He's right. But we are in America,
yes.
So you have to judge the American way.
And what's happened with people like Nancy Silverton,
yes,
is that they've combined the two. They have a great respect
for
classic traditions, but they also love American things, baked goods, so they've learned to combine it. And that's sort of the direction of a lot of the good pastry chefs. So it's not that they're just bakers. They may not have had the exact same training that you or Francois.
You're definitely right. You're definitely right. It's actually good to know both.
Yeah.
I think I'm actually a baker, and I'm actually a pastry chef, and I'm actually a chocolatier. And now I'm making also ice cream. So, you know, because the business that I have, you know, I do a lot of those things. So I understand the reason of Francois saying that, but also understand what's going on into the profession today.
So tell us about the chocolate museum.
You know, when I moved, I just opened a chocolate factory 4 years ago. We have a 40,000 square foot chocolate factory.
This is in Brooklyn.
This is in Brooklyn at the Brooklyn Army Terminal.
But you can buy your chocolates all over the country, we should say.
Thank you. MrChocolate.com. But the chocolate come out of the factory. When I build this factory, my space at Hudson and King, the space of the old factory, became empty. So a friend of mine, his name is Mr. Van Bell, owns few museums around the world, offer me to build a museum in New York. In my turn, offer him to do it in that space, in the space where I used to have my factory. So he came, we look at it, and we decide to build a chocolate museum that's open, in March or April of this year. And we have a 5,000 square foot now, 5,000 square foot of museum, with starting from the Mayan culture all the way to the Spanish, then to the French, the Italian, and then we talk about the different chocolate, white, milk, dark. We talk about plantation, so you have example of all of that. We talk about all the cacao pod, the nibs, the fermentation box. We have a station where we make hot chocolate the Mayan way, knowing that the history of cacao is over 5,000 years old. The history of chocolates is less than 300 years old. So this is the big difference. A huge culture into cacao, but something relatively recent in chocolates. So we explain all that. We also have a demonstration kitchen where we show people how to make chocolate truffles. And we have a third kitchen where you can, for a fee, make chocolate with me or with another teacher that will be there this day. And we teach you how to make chocolate.
So there's interactive. There's interactive components.
Definitely. The entry of the museum is pretty inexpensive. It's $15. And you can eat as much chocolate as you want.
Wow. I'm down. I've started to invite guests to ask me a question. Like, do you have a question for me about Serious Eats or what kind of chocolate
I like? I'm always amazed by your knowledge and culture of food. And you run an interview here, and you go pretty deep into what I do. How do you keep yourself update with talking about all the subjects and be able to do it? How long do you prepare for an interview? That's what amazes me.
It ranges from a few hours to a day. So in your case, I looked at all the books that you had, and as you were talking about how people get information on how to make chocolate, it's the same thing. So I can go online, and by the time I show up here at the studio, I know more about you than you can remember.
But that was my feeling. You know a lot about what I did, but it's not just about me. In your podcast, you know a lot about a lot of people. So my question is, oh my God, is this guy a genius? Or how do we do that? So that was my question.
Most assuredly not a genius. So so do we have chocolates to taste? Oh, good. So, Jacques, you're going to actually get to go home because you did bring the chocolate. You brought the chocolate.
I think my PR asked me to send some chocolates. I don't even know what we have here. Cornflakes chocolate. This is a Le Cirque classic.
Really?
We used to do that at Le Cirque.
So what do you want me to taste, Jacques?
Cheerios. This is a classic.
Okay.
This is so easy, and I find that delicious. So this is so easy and good. And it's dark chocolate, 62% cocoa content, mixed with cornflakes. I mean, how much easier than that can you go? But you know what? You take that at home, on the evening, watching TV, you nibble on it, you're going to love it.
This whole bag would be gone in a matter of minutes.
This is one of those simple, good, no pretentious. This is not very French, but it's good.
Oh, my God.
And, of course, the classic cookies that we make. Today, I had an interview about how to make good chocolate chips cookies. And we stay at least 30 minutes on the phone with the reporter that is writing that article. And she told me at the end, she said, oh, my God, I didn't know that was so much about cookies.
Oh, my God.
So those cookies are, you know, we are very popular, let's say.
Yeah. Well, wow. Those cornflake things, man, I am so down with that. You need to leave pounds at the
studio.
Easy to make. So now it's time for the special sauce all-you-can-answer buffet. There's no time clock, you know, so you can think about your answers. So who's at your last supper? No family allowed.
You know, look, I have a big, deep admiration for a few people. Leonardo da Vinci. This guy, in one life create and do more things than people in 10 lives. So if I can have a dinner with him, my God, that will be so
cool. I like where you're going. Keep going.
Another one will be, and you're going to laugh about that one, Mr. Mars from M&M Mars. What I learned from him, he was quite genius. He is the one who came up with M&M. He is the one who came up with the sneakers. This guy creates so many worldwide hit. M&M's is the first candy or chocolate sold in the world. This is crazy to me.
So I like it. Okay.
Having a dinner with him? Oh, my God. That will be so cool.
Two more people. Politicians?
I don't want to talk about politics today. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
It's a dangerous slope here. Right. You know, this all is right. crazy.
What are you eating?
This is funny because I walk years into very fancy places. Le Cirque, the Negresco, those dinner that go for 3 hours and cost hundreds of or $1,000 with wine and impeccable service and this and that. But one of my memorable lunch or dinner, I think that was a lunch, was actually in Ibiza on a beach. My cousin take me there. Can Pujol is the name of the place. The owner go fishing, bring back fish, open his restaurant, cook his fish, make the paella, make whatever dish he does. When he ran out of fish, he closed. And I had one of the best dinner ever there.
Simple grilled fish.
It was actually more complicated. What he did, he does some type of what we call a bouillabaisse, which is the fish cooked into a bouillon, into a liquid, and then with some little piece of potatoes, with some saffron and some spice, and he bring that. So we eat the flesh of the fish. There was some John Dory, there was some very interesting fish. Then, when we was done, he take our plates, our dish, bring it back in the kitchen, and cook down all the fish with a little bit more liquid and cook rice with it, with a little bit of cuttlefish.
Sounds perfect.
And he bring back the rice. The rice was the thickness of your pinky, so very thin in a big paella pan, and he reduced all the liquid, so the flavor of the fish was there. He used Bomba rice, which is one of the best rice in the world. And when you eat that, it's, oh my God, that was so good. And it was in front of the ocean, on the beach. And the owner was there. Look, people think I was crazy, but I get up on top of my table, climb on the table, I'm sorry, and start clapping on my hands. And I make the whole restaurant clap to the chef. And everybody was like so surprised, but everybody went for it. And the chef was so happy because he never had a crazy guy like me doing that. And I tell him, my God, this is one of the best dinner. And he has no idea what I do for a living.
That's
but
funny.
I eat in a lot of places. I eat El Bui, I eat in magical places. But that was unbelievable to me.
That's great.
So I will do that. I will go back there.
And would there be a dessert? Doesn't there have to be a sweet? Or do you just have too much in your everyday life?
Unfortunately, that's not a place for sweets. We need to travel. Okay. Look, the best place for sweets is Paris.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Whatever we say, whatever, you know, even Tokyo. Tokyo is good, but oh my God, Paris.
Yeah.
Oh, the pastry chefs in Paris are really amazing. And I think they are the best in the world. Look, I never walk in Paris, so, you know, I think I'm fair to say that I think Paris is the city for pastry. Still today, is one of the most romantic city, but for desserts, Paris is amazing.
Yeah. So what do you cook when there's not much in your house to eat or to work with? Like, do you make scrambled eggs? What's your go-to when there's really nothing and you haven't had a chance to shop?
Look, you can do a pretty good dish with spaghetti, a little bit of garlic, some fresh herbs, a little bit of butter or very, you know, virgin olive oil. It's all about the product and your techniques. And you can do some pretty good stuff with very little things. It really can be enough if you don't have much. If I have more, then I like to cook a little bit more.
Got it.
I have to say that I discovered a few years ago slow cooker. I love slow cooker. And I actually love to cook American dish. It can be ribs, it can be pulled pork. Or with the slow cooker, it's so easy and it's so tasteful.
So what's your guilty pleasure? I hope you're going to say M&M's. No, what's your guilty pleasure?
M&M is good. I went to the M&M factory in Hackettstown and I taste the fresh peanuts M&M.
right off the assembly line?
I'm telling you, try that. It's so good. My guilty pleasure is creamy.
Creamy.
I don't know if many people give you that answer, but I love creamy. I think that some people love crispy into dessert. Some people love cakey. I love creamy. Give me...
Anything creamy and you're good.
Give me a good Napoleon with a little bit of the crispiness and then the creaminess of a good pastry cream and a little bit of whipped cream. That creaminess is great. Give me a nice real crème brûlée or...
An éclair.
Yes, if it's well done. An éclair can be, because I don't want
I
too much of the dough.
I didn't say a mediocre éclair.
Éclair can be magical if it's well done.
All right.
So I love creamy. I'm not crazy for cakey. Crispy, I need to have some cream in. So I love creamy.
Right. So it's just been declared Jacques Torres Day. What's happening all over the world?
We're all going to love chocolates. We're going to bath with it. We're going to massage with it. We're going to eat it. We're going to have share pleasure with it. Chocolates. Oh, my God.
That's perfect. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Jacques Torres.
Merci, Ed. That was a pleasure.
Oh, it's great. Mr. Chocolate is in the house, and he did bring some chocolate. You can order some of Jacques' chocolates, the ones I just tasted, online. You can check out his shops and his chocolate-making facility in New York. And when you're here, do check out the Choco Story New York Chocolate Museum and Experience with Jacques Torres. Thank you, my friend.
Ed, merci beaucoup.
Until next time, serious eaters.